The next case is 06-1245, 06-1383, State of Ohio versus Ronald Payne. Mr. Skandelis.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Paul Skandelis, and I'm the attorney on behalf of the defendant appellant Ronald Payne in this case, Mr. Taylor. Your Honors, the key questions in this case can be condensed easily into the following several issues. First, the Supreme Court held in Foster in at least seven series of remand cases pending on appeal prior to and after the release of Foster that sentence imposed in violation of the United States Supreme Court decision in Blakely versus Washington were invalid. And as a result, it issued a broad remand order in all of those cases. Second, 10 of Ohio's 12 appellate districts have relied on that clear language in Foster in finding that resentencing was required in all of those cases. Third, the Supreme Court has held that the waiver doctrine is discretionary in specific cases of plain error or where the rights and interests involved may warrant it. Fourth, the Supreme Court has recently held in State versus Elmore that remand is required for Foster-Blakely sentencing errors even though the issue before the court may be moot. And five, Apley's argument that this court is not required to consider issues not properly preserved ignores the fact that that's what 10 appellate districts have chosen to do based upon the express language of this court in Foster. It also ignores that this court has the authority to consider issues not properly preserved in constitutional matters. The court chose to do that because of the remand order it fashioned in Foster, the nature of that remand order. The court determined that resentencing or ordering a remand in all these cases was necessary because of the nature of that remand order. Now, notwithstanding this history, Apley urges this court to disregard the language of Foster, disregard the language of the seven remand orders, and to reverse the holdings of those 10 appellate districts. I would ask the court to consider two general areas at the outset. These are that the waiver doctrine is discretionary. Ohio courts have never adopted an absolute waiver rule. In Hill versus Urbana, this court held in 1997 that even where waiver is clear, the court reserves the right to consider constitutional challenges, the application of statutes, in specific cases of plain error, or where the rights and interests involved may warrant it. Now, Apley argues that in State versus Campbell in 1994, this court overturned that language and stepped back from it, and in fact held that waiver was appropriate only in cases where there is plain error. Hill versus Urbana, however, was decided 3 years after the holding of this court in State versus Campbell, and since that time, all the appellate districts have been relying upon the doctrine introduced or discussed, first in NRA MD and later in Hill versus Urbana. Apley's suggestion that plain error is the exclusive means by which to reverse based on a waived error is simply not correct. Now, Ohio courts have continuously held that they have the discretion to consider waived issues where the rights and interests of the parties involved may warrant it. The holding in Foster in its seven remand orders reflects that, even though this court noted in Foster that it was incurring a substantial cost, not just in expense, but also in effort. At paragraph 104 of its decision, this court noted that the decision of Foster was going to impose significant time and resource demands and cause disruptions. The court understood the impact of its decision and what could result from it. The circumstances in Foster, however, and the Foster appeals warranted reversal without regard to whether the issue was raised in the trial court, we would maintain.
Mr. Skandelis, if I could turn your attention to Washington versus Requenco, because that case, that was a U.S. Supreme Court case that came after Foster and was very clear in talking about the Apprendi-Blakely line of cases that we referred to in Foster, and looked carefully at it and said that there is such a thing as harmless error when we're looking at statutes of the type that we severed from our sentencing structure. When you look at the fact that individuals now, when they are resentenced, when they were resentenced under Foster, were basically sentenced under a less favorable statute structure the second time around, can't you consider that this is harmless rather than structural error?
Let me address this in two ways. First, Washington versus Requenco held that the failure to submit a sentencing factor to the jury, as discussed by the United States Supreme Court in Blakely and subsequent cases, was not structural error. As a result, the court could decide that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. We'd maintain, though, that the nature of Ohio's remedy was a drastic one in this case, and still the court could find that because, based on the nature of that remedy, that reversal is required. But second, 6 months after the release of Requenco, this court held in State versus Elmore that the Foster-Blakely errors violated a defendant's constitutional rights and must be corrected. The state in Elmore, in a unanimous decision, held that even though the issue was moot with respect to the defendant in Elmore. And in Elmore, this court upheld the defendant's death sentence, and yet on lesser charges, chose to reverse and remand for a resentencing hearing to bring the sentencing in line with Foster. And this court felt that the circumstances were appropriate under those that line of reasoning.
However, we were not presented with this issue of harmless error and the waiver question in that particular case.
With respect to the issue of harmless error, let me again address that in several different ways. First, the reality is the sentences can be reduced on remand. And you are correct that many of the factors that favor the defendant were removed from the sentencing law by the effect of State versus Foster. This does not mean that all defendants in these cases will necessarily get the same sentence. And we know as a matter of fact that some of the defendants do benefit from the resentencing hearings. There are defendants who go in front of different judges, either because the judges have retired or the judges have been removed or the cases are reassigned. There are defendants who have more favorable factors to present to the court at the time of resentencing, either because counsel is more effective or more capable or more diligent, or because the defendant has performed well inside the institution, has an exemplary institutional record, and can demonstrate that he has benefited, received the rehabilitative benefits from his sentence. And these issues can be presented to the trial court. But for whatever reason, we do know that some defendants do receive lesser sentences. It might be a minor set of might be a minor number of defendants, but it does happen. And the
we also know that a number of defendants can receive a greater sentence. The judge down in Hamilton County couldn't hardly wait to get some of these back and unloaded on them. I believe at least those were the news accounts. I have the same question that Justice Lansinger had. I guess I really thought when Foster came out that a lot of attorneys would advise their clients who had these Blakely appeals midstream would say, we ought to drop the appeal and be satisfied with the sentence that you received already, because there's great risk in going back. Is that wrong, or?
Actually, that would be the choice each defendant would make. And that's critical also to Justice Lansinger's question. These cases should really be decided on a case-by-case basis. What two of the appellate districts have done is issued a broad order, finding that in all of these cases, the error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And the courts are not looking at the specific facts in those cases. The courts don't know that this defendant has, whether this defendant has benefited from favorable performance of the institution, or he might have a better counsel who has information to present to the court.
But there you're talking about basically the opportunity for a second bite at the apple. Here, we're looking at a situation where in the Foster remedy, we did not change, or we did not say that individuals now are deserving of lesser sentences. We took away the unconstitutional portions, as we understood it through the Blakely Apprendi cases. We did not have the advantage of Requeno at that time, which said the harmless error doctrine still may apply in each particular state. And here, when you look at Ohio, which basically, for the defense point of view, makes it more difficult for defendants in sentencing than it was before, the waiver situation should enter in here as a under the harmless error analysis.
But I would still maintain, however, that in none of the cases that you see arising, coming up from the 9th and the 10th districts, do we see any case-by-case analysis in any of those cases. It is an across-the-board finding, and that would be inappropriate. But beyond that, the logical extension of this argument, and the extension the state is making, is that in none of these cases would you have any error that is not harmless error, which the state really is saying to this court is that there should have been no remand for resentencing under Foster. That in none of those cases does a defendant stand any likelihood at getting an improvement or receiving a lesser sentence. What the state will tell you is that all of these cases involve harmless error. And in none of these cases, in none of the Foster cases that were remanded to the trial court at great expense to the counties, should these defendants have been resentenced. And that's not the standard that this court should choose to impose. The state will tell you that each of those Foster remands and each of the orders issued since Foster in the 7 cases, the hundreds of cases that went back, should not have gone back for new sentencing hearings. We would maintain that in some of those cases, that the defendants certainly could have benefited from a new sentencing hearing. The bottom line, though, is what this court seems to have held in Foster and what this court held in Elmore several months after Ruiz-Wanco was decided was that there was such a drastic change to Ohio sentencing law that the defendants received terms that exceeded the presumptive maximum term that the court was allowed to impose. And because of that, a new sentencing hearing was required. The court imposed a sentencing term that exceeded the maximum that was available to the judge without jury findings. And because of that, the cases should go back for a new hearing. It was the nature of the remedy that made this court decide that remand across the board without limitation was appropriate. And that is structurally sound. Let me also suggest that what this court did with respect to its holding in Foster was to link the Foster line of cases with the post-release control cases, the cases based on Jordan and Cruzado, and found that those cases were comparable, that the failure of the trial courts to impose a period of post-release control as required by statute mandated that they be reversed, even though the state failed to object timely, failed to appeal timely to those challenges. The court held that in both sets of cases, the judgment entries were invalid and reversal was required. You should not unlink those cases now. I would reserve the remaining minute 50 seconds for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Skandelis. Mr. Taylor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. First off, I would like to correct something in my brief. At page 17, I talked about a Lexis search I had done, basically looking for cases in which this court talked about the failure to object had waived all but plain error. And I said 101 cases I had found, and in fact, it's 100. That was just a typo. I wanted to correct that. I think this court's decision in State versus Perry, a 2004 case, which I've cited in my brief, lays out the correct framework for addressing plain error and harmless error. What Perry says is that if there was no objection in the trial court preserving the issue, then the issue is addressed by the appellate court under a plain error standard of review pursuant to Criminal Rule 52B. The defendant bears the burden of proving plain error. The appellate court has the discretion to disregard it, and error correction for plain error will only be allowed if there is a manifest miscarriage of justice. Perry also says if there was an objection, then the error is reviewed. The issue is reviewed under a harmless error standard under Criminal Rule 52A, and the government bears the burden of proving that the error was harmless. In the present case, the state should prevail under a plain error standard because there was no Blakely objection at the time of this defendant's sentencing, even though Blakely had been decided 10 months before the sentencing. But even under a harmless error standard, the state should still prevail, as the Blakely-Foster error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In Foster, this court severed the presumptions for minimum and concurrent sentencing and severed the findings that were needed to overcome those presumptions. And it's our contention that those presumptions only benefited the defendant. And Foster does show that the trial court erred in thinking that those presumptions applied, and that the trial court also erred in thinking it must make these findings. But these errors were only things that could have benefited the defendant. And could only have prejudiced the state. They were things in favor of the defendant. And when the trial court errs in the defendant's favor, in the appellant's favor, that's not a basis for reversal. The error is harmless. It does not amount to plain error. Our contention is that a plain error standard applies because this state has a longstanding and strict rule in favor of waiver when there's been no objection. In the Murphy case, this court emphasized the importance of this rule by saying it goes to the heart of the adversary system. And this court has said that the waiver rule applies to issues regarding sentencing, and I've cited State versus Coleman in my brief, and State versus Elmore, more recently decided by this court, also mentions that waiver applies to a sentencing issue in that case. This court has also said in State versus Awan that the waiver rule applies to constitutional issues as well. So we have this longstanding and strict rule of waiver when the appellant has failed to object, and we think that should apply to the Blakely issue, the Blakely-Foster issue, just as it applies to a whole panoply of other issues.
Was the sentence that Mr. Payne received, if Foster were applied, a void sentence?
Well, I do not think it's a void sentence, and I think what constitutes a void sentence is the State versus Beasley line of cases, which talks about a sentence that facially falls outside the statutory range, and that would be a void sentence in my view. Now, this court in Foster did talk about when a sentence is deemed void, the ordinary course is to reverse and remand for resentencing. I think void was somewhat misplaced there in that sentence, because if it's the ordinary course, that implies that there are some cases where the case may not be ordinary and that a resentencing may not be required. So I do not believe this is a void sentence problem. I don't believe this is a Beasley problem.
Mr. Taylor, we have used the term void in a couple of cases, and I would agree with you on the Foster situation that term might have been misplaced. Is there a way to look at Beasley, as you say, in a very limited sense? If we looked at the Beasley situation and look at what we did in Foster, we would not be talking about any void sentences whatsoever, would we?
I don't think we are looking at any void sentences.
Because we're not talking about something that was outside the stated limits that the legislature had created for each specific crime.
This court retained the same statutory ranges that had existed prior to Foster. And And this court has said that sentencing errors are not jurisdictional. And Resuenco, or Resu, I'm not quite sure how I pronounce it, but the Resuenco case confirms that it's not jurisdictional under the federal constitution because it's subject to harmless error analysis and it's not structural. So I think there's several indicators that it's not a void sentence. In addition, when this court severed the presumptions and findings that were needed to overcome the presumptions, those things never really existed because case law from this court, and I cite Middletown versus Ferguson for the proposition that when this court finds something unconstitutional, it's void ab initio in the sense that it never really applied. Now, there's an exception for that for cases that have already become final, but so really the presumptions and findings never really existed as to pending cases, and so they couldn't not have had any real effect on what the true statutory ranges were that were applicable to the defendants in pending cases. Now, it's our contention that Foster did not decide the issue of whether waiver applies to post-Blakely failures to object. Now, clearly the court did decide whether a failure to object would constitute a waiver in relation to sentencings before Blakely, and that was clear in paragraph 31, but this court emphasized that the sentencing in the Foster case was before Blakely. This defendant was sentenced well after Blakely, and he cannot rely on the same excuse that the defendant in Foster did. This court said in Foster that Blakely was an unexpected decision, and it could not have been predicted. This defendant cannot make that same contention. Blakely had already been decided for 10 months. United States versus Booker had been decided for 3 months. And so the issue was there. The defense could have raised the issue, and the failure to object cannot be excused. And on that basis, Foster is distinguishable. Now, what the defense contends is that basically this court, in talking about remanding the cases for resentencing, basically what the defense is contending is that this court was issuing an advisory opinion. None of the cases in Foster, the four cases before this court, involved a post-Blakely sentencing hearing. And it's our contention, given this court's long line of cases saying that this court will not render advisory opinions, that Foster should not be read as settling the question of whether waiver applies to post-Blakely sentencings. In fact, it's our contention that although Foster doesn't decide the issue, there's several comments in Foster that we think supports the view that waiver can apply. First, the court emphasized in paragraph 31 the timing of the hearing in the Foster case. Foster had been sentenced before Blakely. Now, unless that's an insignificant fact, and unless it really doesn't matter that he was sentenced before Blakely, then that observation is just a gratuitous observation. We think it bears some significance that this court focused on the timing of the Foster hearing. And I think that could serve as a basis to distinguish the Foster ruling on pre-Blakely sentencing hearings. Second, this court heavily relied on the Booker decision in fashioning the severance remedy. And in Booker, the U.S. Supreme Court expressly recognized that waiver and plain error would apply. Third, this court stated in paragraph 103 in Foster that, I want to quote, when a sentence is deemed void, the ordinary course is to vacate that sentence and remand for a new sentencing hearing. It's our contention that the use of the phrase ordinary course suggests that ordinarily there will need to be a remand, but not in every case. Fourth, this court emphasized in paragraph 104 that this court was ordering resentencings based on the dictates of the U.S. Supreme Court. So when the 10th District and the 9th District were looking at these cases, and when they saw that this court was emphasizing that it was following U.S. Supreme Court precedent, it was common sense to look at page 268 of the Booker decision and see that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that waiver and plain error analysis would apply. And so I think there are several indicators in Foster that waiver can apply. Foster didn't actually decide the issue, and the issue remains open. But we think, given the longstanding waiver doctrine that applies in this state, that this court should apply waiver
Mr. Taylor, with respect to State versus Elmore, would you comment on that, please? Did we do anything that would be inconsistent with your position here?
Well, on the waiver issue, Elmore is not on point because there was a reference to an objection having been made in the trial court. So Elmore doesn't really address the waiver issue, number one. As far as and number two, it was a pre-Blakely sentencing. And so it would fit within the Foster ruling that said that you didn't need to make an objection before Blakely because Blakely was unexpected.
So if we accepted your position here, there would be no cases that we would have to modify in that we have handled in the past on the on these particular issues?
I don't think you need to overrule Foster. I think you just or Elmore, you just recognize the limits of those decisions insofar as the waiver issue goes. The harmless error issue is, I think, somewhat different, and that's an alternative argument we're making that the Blakely-Foster error, by definition, is harmless error because this court was the sole effect of the Foster ruling was to remove things that were favorable to the defendant. And the trial court's error in thinking that those things were applicable and applying those things in the defendant's favor could not be prejudicial to the defendant. Now, in Elmore, there's some reference to how the court was making unconstitutional findings and how it was improper to do that and to make the worst form of the offense and the other findings that applied under Senate Bill 2. And I think my response to that is that it's not improper, even after Foster, for a trial court to consider worst form of the offense, consider demean the seriousness and these other types of things that Senate Bill 2 talked about, because those are always things that a trial court can consider under the purposes and principles of sentencing under 292911 and as sentencing factors under 292912. And in fact, in Foster, this court emphasized that those purposes and principles and sentencing factors would still apply in sentencing. The trial court in this case did not err by looking at the seriousness of the offense, saying it was the worst form of the offense, looking at the harm that was caused by the offenses. Those are things that are always appropriate to consider. The only error by the trial court was in thinking that there was this presumption here that the trial court had to overcome. That presumption no longer exists, and that error is harmless to the defendant because it was an error, the trial court's error was in the defendant's favor.
Mr. Taylor, assuming for argument assuming for argument purposes, this court should determine that based on our prior cases that waivers not available in this situation, is there still some value in finding that harmless, and should we find that harmless error is available, there's still some value in terms of judicial economy in that, or is it really sort of all sort of wrapped together, whether there's any in the terms of, you know, the numbers of things and the burden on the courts, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I think this court should apply harmless error if it thinks it fits, and judicial economies and things like that are, I mean, harmless error is part of the law of this state under Criminal Rule 52A, and it's part of the Sixth Amendment jurisprudence as a result of Resuenco. So I think this court should apply harmless error, and I'm not quite sure whether I answered your question or not, but and I think as far as Sixth Amendment jurisprudence goes, Resuenco says it's subject to harmless error analysis, so I think you should apply it. And just one final point, if I may. The defense talks about, well, there's all sorts of practical things that could have occurred. The judge could have changed, could have a better lawyer on remand, those types of things. That's not what you're addressing in determining whether Foster error is harmless or not. You're looking at whether the legal error committed by the court is harmless. You're not looking at whether there's a possibility or a chance that something may have changed subsequently that may make a practical difference. The question is whether the legal error in Foster is harmless or prejudicial. And we submit that it's not prejudicial because Foster on the whole was detrimental to defendants and not favorable. In conclusion, unless there are no further questions, unless there are any other questions, I would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the 10th District.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Mr. Scandellos, you've saved a minute and 45 seconds of your time.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, I would emphasize six things very quickly. First, we cannot hold that each of the cases involved before this court involves harmless error without making a case-by-case analysis, even notwithstanding what the state is arguing in this case. Without considering the facts of each case, you don't know what the outcome of those cases might be if they're remanded. Second, waiver is not an issue in this case because, first, the clear language of Foster, the express language of Foster upon which 10 appellate districts relied, tells us that these cases must be remanded. But second, the waiver doctrine is discretionary under the doctrine of Hill versus Urbana. And under these circumstances, these are cases where the rights and interests involved may warrant a reversal, notwithstanding the fact that the issue was not preserved in the trial court. And third, the meaning of this argument, as Mr. Taylor indicates to you, is that all Foster cases should not have been reversed, and none of the Foster cases should those cases have been reversed, and new sentencing hearings ordered. Third, under the language of Beasley, the sentence imposed in this case was void. In Beasley, this court held that any attempt by a court to disregard statutory requirements when imposing a sentence renders the attempted sentence a nullity or void. The sentence imposed in this case was beyond the sentence that the judge was authorized to impose. It exceeded the statutory mandatory term, the presumptive mandatory term, without jury findings. And to that extent, it was an illegal and improper sentence. Fourth, Apley argues that this court recognized that the defendants in Foster were sentenced before Blakely, yet in many of the defendants in the remand cases were post-Blakely, and many of those defendants were involved in cases in which Blakely was not raised in the trial court, as recognized by the 7th District in Buchanan. Thank you, Your Honors. I would ask you to reverse and remand in this case.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session.